President Trump ran in a 2024 campaign on no new wars. We're going to end the ones that were on the table, and we are definitely, definitely not going to get into another forever war. That's what the Democrats do, right? That's one of the things you said, oh, snap. Now here we are in the second year of his administration, and suddenly it looks like that's exactly where we're heading. And statements by President Trump here just recently do nothing to assuage against that concern that we may get into an open-ended conflict here with no end in sight at all. And then the question is, what about our allies? Where are they in all this, especially those in Europe? What are they saying? Are they about to come riding to the rescue, or Houston, do we have a problem there too? We're going to try and figure that out. And we have back with us today one of our favorite guests here that I'm so happy to have back with us, Patrick Bob, which is one of Germany's best and most critical international journalists. Mr. Bob is the author of the best-selling book On Both Sides of the Front, where he shares his experiences traveling in the Donbass. He also worked for many years as an editor for the North German broadcasting company NDR, was also a lecturer at two different universities. And man, do we need some lectures here, Professor, in Washington, D.C., with some of our leaders. Welcome back, and we'd love a little wisdom here.
Hello, thank you very much, Daniel, for this invitation. It's great to have you here. So this morning, Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who's well known in America and Europe as well, spoke that our countries are run by mentally unstable people. And I think he's completely right. We have leaders in Europe and in the United States as well who cannot oversee the outcome of their own decisions. And that's the situation we have to face right now. And when the countries are run by madmen, everything can happen.
And, you know, it's funny because oftentimes people say, oh, well, this guy's mentally unstable. It's just kind of a pejorative. It's like, oh, well, I don't like what he's doing. I think it's dumb. But Mr. Bob, I think we have to start to come to the conclusion that it may not be just a pejorative, but it may be an accurate description of what some of our leaders are doing. Now, I think my personal opinion, you can argue if you want to the contrary, but I think the majority of those, and the first one is on the screen right there in President Trump. And let me give you the latest example why. He just published this just hours ago here, kind of a new ultimatum. You know, he did one a week or so ago with 48 hours, and he moved it to 5 days, and then he moved it to 10 days. And then now here again, it's moved again. Almost by itself, that right there is part of the problem. But let me show you what the reason why I say that we need to start questioning, is there more to it than this? He starts off by saying the United States of America is in serious discussions with a new and more reasonable regime in Iran to end our military operations there. Great progress has been made. First of all, there's no evidence whatsoever that there's any genuine negotiations, much less progress made. But I continue, if for any reason a deal is not shortly reached, it will probably be. And if the Hormuz Strait is not immediately open for business, we will conclude our, quote, lovely stay in Iran by blowing up and completely obliterating all their electric generating power plants, oil wells, Karg Island, and possibly all desalinization plants. Now, even just on the surface there, just on that right there, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong, but those are some pretty black and white war crimes that he's talking about committing.
Well, there is a decision to be made in Washington. The United States and the Western world can suffer from a step-by-step escalation of this iron wall because the Iranian troops are going on to hit Western and facilities of the United States, military facilities, but also companies and oil-producing plants in the Gulf region. And this is a serious threat to Western economy in delivering oil and gas for the chemical industry, for the farming business, and all that. So the Iranians are not interested to stop this war, and they will go on and go on. Or President Trump, if he doesn't want to suffer a long war, a war of attrition, he can make a decision and decide to bring boots onto the ground. So the United States have 50,000 soldiers around the Gulf area, and he brought in paratroopers and special forces, and he spoke of Kark Island, which hosts big oil-producing facilities. 90% of the oil and gas exports of Iran is provided off Kark Island. But this is not the important island. The important island is the Qasem Island in front of Bandar Abbas, right exactly at the Strait of Hormuz. And to make a landing operation on this island, Qasem Island, is much more difficult. This island has a length of about 200 kilometers and is 40 kilometers broad. And there is no shelter for landing troops, nothing. And American troops will be hit by Iranian missiles and drones. So I think the outcome would be a suicide mission. And we saw at the weekend 7 million American people demonstrating in the streets, protesting against this war. And those people in the streets in America will be getting more and more. That means that Mr. Trump and the Republican Party will see a hard blow at the next midterm elections in November. So the show for Mr. Trump is over. He miscalculated the situation completely. And our European leaders are complete vessels. I would say they are unable to think about their own situation, but they feel that they are so close to the negative outcomes of the American policy that they feel their own political career depends on the success of America. And the outcome is they won't have a longer career. Their show also is over. So that's my evaluation.
We're going to specifically look at least a couple of different European leaders and kind of where this is and where there's actually a foreign minister meeting. Secretary of State Rubio is attending, and he got a little bit of hostile questions from some of the reporters. More on that in a second. But as a lead in, I want to take a look at what's facing all these decisions, because you have to take into consideration what's happened militarily. You just talked brilliantly about the difficulty of taking Qasem Island or Karg or anything else in there, and there's the military difficulty of it. But not doing that also has some additional near-term problems. I mean, we can take a look at number one. We're running out of interceptor missiles. This is Israel here, and they're already starting to ration them, and they're running through some of the capable, the PAC-3 capabilities. We're having to go to some of the older versions of that. The U.S. is using a lot of its offensive Tomahawk missiles more than in any other war we fought in decades, and we're a month in. And then we have the issue of, and you've talked about this a little bit on the Iranian side, they have foreseen this and have built these underground missile cities. Here's one of them at Yazd, which is one of the more important ones. But this graphic here depicts just how nearly impossible it is for us to bomb them, because they have built them into granite mountain size, not just underground, but a long way. And then the militarily, I mean, look, our USS Carrier Ford already had to abandon the fight because it had, allegedly anyways, some internal fires and some other equipment failures. And now we're bringing another aircraft carrier in. So obviously things are not going well from our perspective. But then here's the real issue, the real kicker. And you kind of mentioned some of this. and that is the oil issue and its ramifications for fertilizers and for fuel and other kinds of things. Here you have in South Korea, they're having strict vehicle rationing already. That's already happening in Vietnam, Bangladesh, Manila. There's a protest because they're waiting in line just for gasoline for mopeds and motorcycles, et cetera. That's already happening. And then this one here, this is what I want you to talk about a little bit. This graphic was put up by JP Morgan and said, listen, we already have baked in, even if the strait opens tomorrow, there's going to be major disruptions coming because of how long it takes a lot of these ships to get different places in various places where there's going to be some real problems. April 15th for the United States, even we are going to have some problems. April 10th for Europe, April 1st already in Asia, you're seeing that happen. Australia, Africa, et cetera. But I want to zero in on this, the part about Europe. How concerned are people in Europe, at least publicly, about the fact that literally just less than 2 weeks from now, they're going to be in some pretty dire straits with petrol?
Well, at German gas stations, I saw yesterday a price for a liter of gas of €2.20. So people see that.
And what was it before all this? What would be a normal price right now for liter?
170, for example, 160, 178. So it made a big boost. So everybody sees that, because the whole country depends on cars. But there is no rumor in the public. People is quiet, and I think the German people, the majority of the Germans, is sleeping against the abyss. And the mainstream media and the the discussion under the political elites are trying to avoid this topic, and they don't go to the roots of the problem. What we will see in the next month, starting right now, is a boost of inflation in Germany and in the Western world, because the gas and oil prices are boosting. And the background of that is that the Houthis in Yemen decided to close the Red Sea, and that means to close the
Bab al-Mandab.
Exactly. And so a quarter of the world's oil and gas transports, oil and gas shipping, must go around South Africa. And that means these tank vessels, need 8 days more. And this makes transport and logistics more expensive. And this is not only a problem of oil and gas prices, it's a problem of Lloyd's in London. The shipping securities and the prices for shipping securities will get higher and higher and higher. And that's a big problem. And we see a delay of the problem in the whole Western world. It will go step by step by step. And the Iranians and the Houthis are trying to bleed us out economically. And I think they will win this war of attrition. They are interested in a longer conflict. The Americans and the Israelis began this war, this illegal war, of course. But the Iranians decide when the war will be over.
And you know, the issue here is not just the oil and the price of petrol, as important as that is, and you kind of touched on this a second too with farmers, but it's also food. Global food supplies face a dangerous bottleneck as Iran war persists. The World Trade Organization, WTO Director General, said that the conflict has destabilized trade in energy, fertilizer, and food at a time when governments were already struggling with geopolitical trade tensions as well as climate pressures. It's no secret that the world's trading system is experiencing the worst disruption in 80 years. That's a really big statement. Do you think that's an overcharacterization, or are we really facing something that on a global scale could be the most with both energy and food?
I think, well, I agree to this scientist, and I think this interruption of oil and gas transports will hit the Western world much harder than the oil crisis in 1973. And it will hit us much longer than the oil crisis in 1973. I think this is part of the decline of the Western world. We are hanging ourselves up in an economic way, and everybody will see that, because you need gas to produce fertilizer, and you need fertilizer to produce food for 8 billion people in this world. And the food prices will boost in the next month over summer. We will see that in the United States, but much more in Europe, because the United States have gas of its own. And we don't have gas. We have nothing. Because we cut the cooperation, the energy cooperation with the Russian Federation, and now our links to the Persian Gulf and to the oil and gas factories in the Persian Gulf are cut as well. So we hit in a double way. We are hit in a double way. And our politicians are prisoners of their own ideology and are vassals of the United States, and they cannot understand that they have to act. They have to negotiate with Moscow to open up, for example, Nord Stream 1, to bring cheap energy to Western Europe. But they don't do. They are prisoners of their own ideology. They want to bring the Russian Federation on its knees. But this is not possible. It is not possible economically, it is not possible militarily and politically as well. They have, in the words of President Trump, the Europeans have no cards.
Well, now that seems odd to me. I mean, I can understand what's going on. You and I have talked about this many times about how many in Europe have wanted to cut off their nose to spite their face, especially with this energy, because they bought all these action sanctions and whatnot during the, you know, talking about the Russia-Ukraine war. It's causing all kinds of problems in the Europeans, especially in the German economy, and has for this whole time. But yet politically, the government has been able to resist that pressure. But one wonders, especially if President Putin says, which he's been talking about here just in the last few weeks, you know what, I don't want to wait till 2027 to cut off all of Europe from our gas. We may just cut it off on our own and have a sudden drop. And I know, at least I think anyway, Russia, Germany doesn't specifically get any oil or gas from Russia right now, but others in Europe do. And if that suddenly stops, then that means they're going to have to get it from somewhere else, which has ramifications for all of Europe. I wonder if you can talk to me about that dynamic right now, in light of what's going on in the Middle East.
So President Putin offered to open up Nord Stream as soon as possible, but the Europeans did not react. At the same time, the Russian Federation evaluated if it would be possible to bring the gas transports for Europe down to Asia. So we have both processes. And in the European Union, our politicians are so dependent from the decisions in Washington that they cannot make decisions of their own. They do nothing. They are waiting. They are looking like, well, crazy people. I have no idea what it is. And in Germany, we are supporting this American war. A great part of the logistics of this war went through the military bases in Spandalem and Ramstein in Germany. We had a lot of flights in advance before the war started. And politically, our chancellor told us that we are supporting the American position. There is no interest to criticize our allies and all that. And we have soldiers, the Bundeswehr has soldiers, for example, in Jordan. And at the moment, I cannot say how deeply these soldiers are involved in this American and Israeli war. I have no idea. So it is a situation where the political elites are unable to make the right decisions. And at the same time, the German public is sleeping. Look at the elections in the country of Baden-Württemberg in southwest Germany, a region that is really hard hit by deindustrialization and the great loss of jobs. And many voters, two-thirds of all voters, decided to give their votes to warmongering parties, the Green Party and the Conservatives. So I have no idea what those people have in their brain. Their brain must be done. Their mind must be done. I have no idea.
Well, how long do you think that condition can continue on? Because, I mean, we could be talking like literally just weeks from now, not even many months, to where petroleum prices could continue to go up at the pump. Food could start to become scarce, and it'll all circle back to, well, a combination of both what has been going on with the Russia-Ukraine war and now what's going on in the Persian Gulf. And one may wonder, how long will that support from Germany come up? And now Trump has been very angry about Europe here lately, because they haven't helped with a lot of naval assets to try and open up the Strait of Hormuz. And so far, the German Chancellor Merz is not exactly embracing this, but he's trying to, it looks like he's kind of trying to keep both hands open here, where says European nations have been reluctant to get involved in the conflict, angering President Trump. I'm just not convinced that what's happening right now, what Israel and America are doing, will actually lead to success, Friedrich Merz said at a conference hosted by FAZ newspaper. We are trying to influence Israel with limited success, I admit, he added. Merz said that he had sought in a recent phone call with Trump to explain, this is not NATO's war, adding, I think he understood this. How would you characterize Chancellor Merz's performance here, and what is he trying to accomplish?
Well, I think he's really afraid of American pressure. Mr. Trump expressed his wish that NATO allies should bring in ships into the Strait of Hormuz to open up this sea strait. And this is, well, a suicide action as well. And Chancellor Merz did not want to see dead bodies coming home. And this is his reaction. He said, okay, this is not NATO's war. We don't want to be directly involved. We are supporting the Americans indirectly. That's all. Because bringing back dead bodies would play into the hands of the alternative for Germany. And this is the great fear of the Christian Democrats. And I think the actions of our, or non-acting of our government, will play into the hands of the AfD. And in the next federal elections, the AfD will get a lot of voters and a lot of votings for itself.
And when is the next federal elections?
In 2 years. 2.5 years. So we have
not a long time.
Enough time. Yeah, it is. And I think this is Mr. Merz won't be re-elected. Well, in his own party, he is seen as a loser. And I think there will be a replacement for him. And the next generation of Christian Democrats will find a form of cooperation with the Alternative for Germany. And this could be our new government. And this is exactly what the Team Trump wants in the United States. Well, look in the new security strategy of the United States. This paper, this file expressed clearly that the Americans, Washington, want to make their deal with very conservative European governments. Hungary, Italy, Austria, for example. And this is the way we are trying to reach stability in the empire of chaos by imprisoning or by keeping the Europeans present. And the best way is not to give social democrats a chance, but to give right-wing parties a chance. This is part of the American strategy. So I think nothing will be changing.
And one wonders, I can understand why certainly the Trump administration would like to see the AFD rise up because they think that they're more akin politically to the MAGA movement, et cetera. But if this war continues, you've talked to several times, mentions things that are just militarily impossible and would be suicide if they were attempted. And yet we're in a position to where there is no off ramp that involves military. And the only thing that does exist is a diplomatic side. But the Iranians, by all accounts, have calculated this into their preparation for war and that they can sustain this a long time until they get terms that they want, which would be near political suicide here in the United States for President Trump. So one wonders if this thing keeps going, if it drags on for a lot longer and it's not over at all anytime soon, and petrol prices and food prices start going through the roof, even in Germany, that somehow, even if the AFD was to benefit, that would not necessarily benefit the president's party in the United States. How do you see that?
Yes, that's right. Normally, you could expect a split, a transatlantic split between the interests of the empire, of the hegemon in the United States, and its vassals in Europe. But in German public, I cannot see this split. I see, when I'm going out of my apartment through the streets, I see a majority of political zombies who don't understand what's really happening because they don't want to understand what's really happening. So my impression is that most Germans are thinking, we had 50 years of relative welfare. Let's keep this situation stable as long as possible. And don't let us prepare an unstable future. So they don't want to think about the abyss that's coming up. That's the situation in Germany, but there is no transatlantic spread because our Western European elites are so close to American organizations like German Marshall Fund or Atlantic Bridge or the foundations of Mr. Soros that they linked over decades their own personal career to this transatlantic organizations. And it's like a mirror cabinet. They are all meeting the same guys, which are also linked to the United States, the same publishers, the same managers, the same generals. They all are thinking in the same way. It's like a mirror cabinet. And they cannot imagine, they have no idea of finding an alternative that could be in the interest of German and European people. So well, we don't, in from my point of view, yeah, at the moment, with these elites, we will not come into a transatlantic split.
Yeah, and you know, and I see some very similar dynamics playing out here in the United States, to where there are so many people that can't mentally contemplate what you call an empire of chaos or political zombies, because they want life to just keep going on. They don't want to look out here. And part of that I can understand, just as a human, you don't like change. You're afraid of something that's beyond your control. And yet if our elites, both in the United States and in Europe, don't start doing something pretty difficult, there's going to be some real pain that they can't explain away. And then political zombie or no, you'll be forced into waking up when the reality starts striking hard at your daily life, and you can't keep going on like that. But we're not there yet. We're headed that way. And in fact, it's not even just in Germany. It's all over Europe. But I want to take a little bit of a look at the other reflexive. You talked about a mirror cabinet. I don't think anybody could say there's any more appropriate version of that outside of Germany than the UK. And here's President Trump really kind of throwing the UK big time under a bus. I guess he's not satisfied with that mirror enough.
The UK say that we'll send, this is 3 weeks ago, we'll send our aircraft carriers, which aren't the best aircraft carriers, by the way. They're toys compared to what we have. But we'll send our aircraft carrier when the war is over. I said, oh, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. Don't bother. We don't need it. And we don't need it. And we don't need them.
Yeah, funny you say that we don't need it, we don't need them, because when you look at the information here, the Gerald R. Ford was sent back, and now we're sending another aircraft carrier in, so it kind of looks like we do need it, but Trump is kind of miffed at the British, because they're not sending it fast enough, and he wants them to do something that would be against their national interest, because as you say, naval-wise, trying to force open that strait is not going to work anyway. Well, Keir Starmer is in a tough spot, and this was earlier today when he tried to respond to what Trump had said.
The Iran war, which I know is causing huge concern. People look at their screens, and they're worried when they see explosions, infrastructure blown up, the rhetoric that goes with it, worried about whether this is going to escalate even further. And therefore, it's really important that I reiterate where I stand and where this government stands, because this is not our war, and we are not going to be dragged into it.
Now, he got a lot of claps and a lot of north and south on that one. This is not our war. So on the one hand, nobody wants to get into war, but then I'm wondering if you can explain about what you think is going on, especially at the elite level, where he's getting, trying to placate Trump, and Trump is not being placated, but he's not sending in the aircraft carrier or anything else right now. How do you see that playing out?
From my point of view, Mr. Starmer is not a convincing leader, but he's intelligent enough to see that this war is lost for the West. And he don't want to be involved in a conflict party that is losing the war. And it's very clear that the Iranians have the cards of escalation in their hands. And they are well prepared. And they are backed by the Russians and by the Chinese. The Chinese delivered hypersonic missiles, military equipment, surveillance equipment, satellite information, and all that. And that made it possible to hit American bases around the Gulf area. And they have no means on the Western side. They can bring boots to the ground, but this would backfire. And the show of Mr. Trump will be over very soon. And this is something Keir Starmer feels. And the Brits are not strong enough. They could mobilize 5 or 6 ships to bring them to the Gulf region. And they could mobilize, let me say, 20,000, 30,000 men, who will be destroyed as soon as possible by Iranian missiles. So the West has no cards. And that's a problem. How to bring the worst cards back to Washington? It's a blame game. So let's do this, Mr. Trump. He decided to go into this war, and he should find an off-ramp of his own. That's the whole game which is played right now. And I cannot see a solution. And I think Mr. Trump is a liar. And what he's trying to do right now is, and this is the only small possibility he has, he can declare this war as a victory, and he can end the war. This is the only way to go back, to retreat. There is no option beside a nuclear option. And this is a serious option.
Yeah, I don't. That's one of the things we've been talking about here for a while on our channel, is that our concern that if there is no political off ramp, there's nothing because Trump may already be at the point to where he can't declare victory in any meaningful way, because if he walks away, in whatever phrase he wants to use, but the Strait of Hormuz remains firmly in Iranian control, there is nothing. Their missile forces remains viable, and their political system remains unchanged. You can't spin that one to anybody, even his hardcore supporters. So the question is going to be, what might he do then? And there is a political way he could just have it negotiated out, but it's almost unthinkable that he would take it, because you would have to acknowledge defeat and failure. And yes. Then the alternative is ramping up conventional won't do anything but have more casualties. So that's why I fear that more time that there could be, he may think about seriously resorting to that nuclear card, which would just be catastrophic for mankind. I mean, there's so many negative ramifications to go along with that. I'd like to ask your opinion before we move on to the next other parts of Europe here. Let's stick with the U.S. and U.K. right now, because I think that there is, you use political zombies. That implies that nobody's thinking here and everybody wants to cling on to the past, but the past is gone. I don't think enough people have recognized it, but how do you see the near term, even the near and medium term, playing out here in the next few weeks when these costs that I've mentioned a minute ago start to bite, and the petrol price for everything stays high, the transportation shipping cost stays high, therefore everything else, groceries, manufactured goods, everything starts going up, and then we may not even have enough food to go around. You're not going to be able to stay a zombie. What do you think the U.S. and U.K. could do right now? What cards do you see each side having against the other to try to get them on their side?
In fact, they are sitting in the middle of Scylla and Charybdis. Whatever they are doing, it will be a mistake. To prolong this war means to come more and more deeper and deeper into a war of attrition. And with minor means, the Iranians will win this war of attrition, because a drone is much cheaper as a Patriot missile. And a missile is much cheaper than the so-called Iron Dome that does not work. Militarily, the advantage will getting bigger and bigger for the Iranian side. Economically, there is no way out, because the damage is done. This is the experience of the oil crisis in 1973. The oil prices will boost, but they won't come down at the level before. They will find a level in the middle of between. So the prices will stay very high on the oil and gas markets. And concerning logistics, the shipment assurance, the shipment assurances will get more and more expensive because they have to recalculate, re-evaluate the risks of shipping. And now we have more risks of shipping. And these prices will stay high as well. And this will be a long-term blow to Western economy and is one brick in the decline of the West. And every war which the West will begin will accelerate the decline of the West. And the problem is that our leaders cannot manage the way the transformation from a unipolar world to a multipolar world in a peaceful way. The only idea they have is war and more war and more war. And I think this is a bad idea.
And let's take a look at one of the factors that goes along with that, and that's this issue here. This is WTI, West Texas Intermediate crude. It's currently trading. This is live. We're looking at right here, 102. It was 103 just a second ago. It's popping along there. But you can see that over a period of time here, this has done nothing but go up. It has continued to climb. And do you see anything fundamentally which can intercept that? I mean, the President Trump has tried a few times. Let me see if I can scroll back here. He's made a few statements here that made it drop from it was up over 101 here, and then it dropped down a lot with a statement that he made. But then it started going back up. He made another statement. It went back for a while. But now then you see he's made a number of other statements here, and now nothing is making it go down. It's continued to go up. How do you see this trend? Do you see anything either politically, diplomatically, or economically that can be done, whether by Europe or United States, that can intercept that trend?
Oh, there can be done a lot. President Trump could declare that this war is over, that he lost the war, and he could step back. And then the prices will drop. And this is the way. And then the Iranians will accept that. They want money for the destructions of the war. They want that their hegemony on the Strait of Hormuz will be accepted. They want a long-term peace agreement, and they want to get free hand in the questions of nuclear enrichment for peaceful use. So, and if the United States and Israel would declare that this is okay and find an agreement with Tehran, though the prices will drop. But this is impossible at the same time, because especially Israel does not want to stop this war. Israel is interested to create a large Israel from the river Nile to the river Euphrates. And the only way to do that is to produce chaos in the neighboring states. So Tel Aviv is not interested in stopping the war, and Tel Aviv has a lot of influence in American domestic policy because of the money who ran during the election campaign into the pockets of Mr. Trump and the Republican Party. So I think the show is not over, and I'm expecting that the advisors of Mr. Trump will advise him to go full risks and to bring boots on the ground.
That's what the evidence looks like. That I know for a fact that those are, there's lots of advisors saying exactly that. They want to force and compel compliance from Iran to check all of these advantages you just mentioned. But militarily, I don't see any path to it. It just is going to deepen the loss. Last bit here I want to talk about, though, is what's happened in the rest of Europe. Marco Rubio was en route to a foreign minister's meeting in Europe of the G7, and he was answering some questions he talks about a lot. And then he was asked a bit of a hostile question by one of the reporters. See what you think of this.
Are they all concerned about the reception that you might get when you arrive at
the reception I might get?
Yeah, the reception.
By who?
Well, by all your fellow foreign ministers.
I'm not concerned about it. I'm here on behalf of the United States of America. I look forward to meeting with them. I don't know what reception I would get from them. I think they should be happy that I'm going.
Well,
if not, we don't have to go.
They might be happy, but they're not happy with what's going on.
Well, again, I'm not there to make them happy. I get along with all of them on a personal level. We work with those governments very carefully, but the people I'm interested in making happy are the people of the United States. That's who I work for. I don't work for France or Germany or Japan. These are all good people. We're going to have great meetings.
Chemistry?
But I work for them. I work for the people of the United States.
Man, that's little bit testy there. He's like, yeah, I don't work for them or whatever. But I mean, how would you characterize? You've already said you still think that the political zombies and they're still trying to accede to the United States, but there certainly does seem to be a lot more friction than there was before. How would you characterize the relationship between the United States, especially at the foreign ministry level?
I have to say, it's my fault, but I couldn't understand Mr. Rubio. I couldn't hear that. Because of the noise surrounding him.
Oh, I'm sorry. Generally speaking, he was saying, "Listen, I'm not going there to make friends," because the reporter was asking him. A lot of the European members are not happy with this Iran war, that it's causing lots of problems. And what are you going to say when you meet with them? And he's just like, "Well, I'm not trying to make them happy. That's not what I'm trying to do." But I like them all personally, et cetera. So he's just kind of pushing off on the issue.
Yes. I'd like to compare that with the speech of Mr. Rubio during the Munich Security Conference in February. And he declared over there that the American Empire wants to go back to the 500 years of colonialism, because this would bring peace to the world. And he declared he wanted to do that with the Europeans, but the Americans can do that alone, on their own. And that means we are facing a new time of neo-colonialism, but the world changed. And the global South won't accept that. So we are coming into a century of wars deeper and deeper. And all these words of Mr. Rubio spoken right now on this airport are, for me, the speeches of a political comedian. I don't know. He's telling stories like you can tell stories after six beers in a bar. And this is not a serious statement. It's just stories.
So let's look at in the last few minutes here, kind of widen the lens out a little bit further. If the U.S. and Europe and the Western world writ large are definitely teetering, I think we could charitably say, and you could say collapsing if you want to go a little bit further, how is this being viewed in our competitors' framing, China, Russia, because they don't seem to be collapsing this. And if you want to even tie them together with BRICS issues, which of course Iran is a member of, but even around that, how are people elsewhere in the globe viewing this? Because the centrality of the dollar, especially since 1971, has always been based, obviously not on gold, but on the presumption of the stability of the U.S.-led Western world. And that's why everybody was happy to do business in dollars, because it was safe. Well, now that it's starting to look like it's not safe, and where are we in the process, in the possibility that whole foundation of the dollar could be collapsing, and where might it go with Russia and China?
So both Moscow and Beijing are watching very clearly that the United States are still a superpower, a nuclear superpower, and an economic superpower as well, financial superpower. But at the same time, they see and they calculate that the new Iron War brought a time to show Washington its limits. And they will be successful over there. Iran is the southern point of the North-South corridor of the Russian Federation, the North-South transport corridor from St. Petersburg to the Persian Gulf. And at the same time, Iran is an important hotspot of the new Silk and Road Initiative of China. And both need access to the Persian Gulf, and they both need iron. They cannot drop iron. So this is a war in which Moscow and Beijing are not involved directly, but they are supporting Tehran as good as they can. It is a proxy war for them, and they do what the Americans did in Ukraine all the time. And they learned from the Americans how to do that. And, I'd like to repeat, the targeting of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards on bases and factories in the Emirates and Saudi Arabia is possible by providing satellite information by China and Russia. And they do that. And this is one reason why the West will lose this war. And India is in the middle of between. They don't know how to decide. They have their problems with China. And they don't want to help directly, but they don't help the United States as well. So they are in the middle of between. The BRICS states don't provide a clear picture. But the important powers in the BRICS, under the BRICS states, the Russian Federation and the Republic of China are providing a clear picture. They are going to support Iran, and especially in Beijing, they think now it is time to make America surrender in the Middle East. And I'm sure on the long term, the United States will lose their bases around the Gulf, and they will lose their allies around the Gulf, because the Arab states, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, they learned right now that the American troops don't provide shelter for them, but they bring in foreign missiles and explosions. And so it was never the goal of Washington to bring shelter to the Emirates. It was just propaganda. Yeah. They wanted to have their logistics and their influence in the Middle East. And so this is a lesson to be learned by the Gulf states, and they will learn on the long run. It will be a difficult way, but they will learn. So in the end of the show, the Western Empire will start new wars and will lose new wars.
Well, that's not a very optimistic view, but it's one grounded in reality. It's hard to see how the declining empires rarely go easy or or willingly, and we'll have to wait and see how that's going to work out here. But I think that the larger arc that you're talking about of where this is going in the Middle East, it's hard to argue with. It'll never, never go back to the way things were before this war was chosen by us. And we'll have to reckon with that for probably decades to come. Well, listen, we really appreciate you coming on today. And as always, we're really grateful for the viewpoint that you bring us and your honesty and your integrity. Thank you.
Always my pleasure.
And we thank you guys, too. And to let you know, here in about an hour, we're going to have Trita Parsi on. We're going to take a look at the Iranian side of this. We looked at the U.S., now the European side today. We're going to look and see where are the Iranians in all this, and what are they saying? Are they still struggling pretty bad under some of these bombs, or have they figured out how to weather this storm, and where might they go next, especially diplomatically? Trita Parsi at 2 o'clock today on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. We'll see you then. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.